Hey, Corey.
Hey, Greg.
How you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. So, I should introduce myself. I'm Greg Marks. I'm a staff writer for the Columbia Journalism Review and an editor for our United States project, for which you are a contributor.
Indeed. I'm Corey Hutchins, a correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review's United States project, covering North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia and West Virginia. And today we're going to be talking about the Carolinas and some of the local coverage surrounding the shutdown, right?
We are, definitely. So I should say right at the outset that this conversation is part of a new Democracy in America series for Blogging Heads. CJR and Blogging Heads are both investees of the Democracy Fund. So this is a sort of a new collaboration, and we hope we will sort of have an interesting conversation for viewers. And so, as you said, we're going to mostly be talking about the shutdown, the politics, the economic impacts, and the coverage of the shutdown. And a lot of the, you know, obviously in many respects, it's a national story told, you know, through the relationship between Boehner and Obama and Reid and all the name-calling and negotiations before the cameras, et cetera. But one of the things that we've really tried to do here at CJR is stress the message to the public and to reporters covering the shutdown that the roots of the story are really local and, you know, principally being driven by, you know, a contingent of the House Republican caucus, you know, who obviously members of whom are representing particular local districts and responding to sort of local constituencies. And I know that you've been sort of following that story in South Carolina, where you report in Charleston, and also reviewing the coverage in North Carolina, where which is the home of Mark Meadows, right, who CNN called the man behind the government shutdown.
Yeah, so for what we're talking about here, North Carolina, I think, provides a really interesting lens into some of this local stuff. Now, you mentioned the CNN article, CNN story, which came out around the eve of the actual shutdown. CNN had a headline, and it was a great headline, Architect of the Brink, the man behind the government shutdown. And the story kind of said, now, you might have heard of Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, but actually this guy in Congress, this relatively obscure congressman, might have had more to do with the actual shutdown than Ted Cruz. Who is he? Mark Meadows. And I think for a lot of people, it's the first time they'd ever heard of this guy, Mark Meadows. And they can really be forgiven, now, even some people in North Carolina. Mark Meadows has only been in Congress for 8 months. And, you know, just after that story came out, speaking to a handful of reporters, even reporters in North Carolina, were kind of like, you know, it was a great headline, but Mark Meadows might not have as much clout as people think. So I'll tell you a little bit about why CNN called him the Architect of the Brink, and then maybe we can talk about whether he is or isn't the man behind the shutdown.
Right, because he's tried to sort of subsequently say, like, my role has been a little overstated here.
Yeah, and he's blamed the media for that. He's blamed the media for over-sensationalizing, over-hyping his role now that the government's actually shut down. But some of the stuff that was reported in his local press as far back as August kind of shows a conflicting narrative here. So
and the local press is up in Asheville, right?
Yeah, the largest paper in his area is the Asheville Citizen Times, and they have been reporting on Mark Meadows for a while, and of course their reporting's ramped up after the shutdown, and they've been kind of dogging him in both the editorial page and the news side. And so here's the background to why Mark Meadows might or might not be the man behind the shutdown. Back in July, he had penned a letter basically saying that urging Speaker of the House John Boehner to defund the implementation and enforcement of Obamacare in basically any relevant appropriations bill brought to the House, including any continuing appropriations bill. He was able to, this happened in July, and when he was drafting his letter and circulating his letter and trying to get signatories on the letter, really didn't get much local press, if any, as far as I've seen. Now, he wasn't...
And there are, like, how unusual is this sort of letter? I mean, do these things get drafted
I imagine these kind of things, you know, might get drafted all the time and might not really come out unless the congressman puts out a press release, which he did in August. So he was writing this letter. He wrote this letter in around late July, around July 20th or so, and he was able to get about, he got 79 more signatures on the list. Yeah, so it tops out at about 80 members of Congress. And so when you hear this in the national media, in the Beltway media, people saying that there are a core consistency of about 80 really conservative, ultra-conservative House lawmakers who are behind the shutdown, so to speak, those are the folks that are on this letter. So he signs, he writes the letter, signs the letter, he gets these signatories, and it really doesn't become public until July 24th, Heritage Action, that group, you know, a product of the Heritage Foundation, which is run by Jim DeMint, former senator of South Carolina. That group...
Right, who was recently dubbed, you know, the shadow speaker of the House by Businessweek.
Right, he was. So Heritage Action latches onto that letter, puts it on their website, and urges lawmakers to sign this. You know, you guys need to get behind this. And that's really when it kind of comes out. Politico ended up writing a story. Dave Weigel points out at Slate that the press really only started picking it up after Heritage Action puts it on blast. Politico picks it up, and then there's this letter out there, and it's not until, so that's July 24th, but it's not until like a month later that Meadows puts it on the website, on his house.gov.
On his own website.
Yeah, website. It's like, hey, I wrote this letter. And then the newspapers in North Carolina really jump on it. John Frank, awesome reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, he does this Under the Dome section every morning where he rounds up all the news out of North Carolina. And he linked to a story, I think, in Reuters that day, and the headline was Meadows Leading Charge for Shutdown. Later that week, around August, late August 27th, Meadows hits a town hall meeting up in the Asheville area, and the Citizen Times was there and said that he got boos and applause when he said he would support shutting down the government to stop Obamacare. And maybe not big news at the time, because there were really just grumblings about this conservative strategy to shut down the government. But no one's really coming out saying it, I don't think, except for maybe Mark Meadows at this town hall. And he campaigned on repealing Obamacare like a lot of these conservative House reps did. And at the time, it was at odds with one of the senators up there, Senator Richard Burr, who was saying that, you know, a strategy to shut down the government over Obamacare was, you know, the dumbest idea he'd ever heard, I think is what he said. And you kind of see these kind of moderate statesman Republican senators like Lindsey Graham in South Carolina kind of saying the same thing, you know, like, that's a little too far, guys. But we're still talking about August here. So late August. So still, you know, a month before the actual shutdown. And then Jim DeMint's former PAC, the Senate Conservatives Fund, is kind of running ads against people like Lindsey Graham, trying to say that, you know, somehow they're not going far enough against Obamacare because maybe they aren't willing to tacitly endorse any kind of strategy to shut down the government to get rid of the implementation. So,
so Corey, to go back to Meadows for a second, so, you know, there's been a lot written and reported about the sort of rightward shift of North Carolina's politics in recent years and the success of the Republican Party. Where does he come from? Like, who you know, there's stories about this, the congressman out of Florida who's like a large animal veterinarian who'd like never held elected office before. What's Meta's background?
I haven't seen a really in-depth profile of him yet. I think CNN's really was the biggest one. I reached out to a political science professor, Michael Bitzer at Catawba College, and asked him, can you tell me a little bit about this guy? And he said that he wouldn't fault anybody outside of the 11th district. I think it is. If they never even heard of this guy, kind of came out of nowhere. I talked to a reporter in Raleigh who said that he's an interesting guy, and he'd been pushing for a profile of him in the Raleigh paper for a while, but hasn't been able to get that yet. And he called him a Floridian in suede loafers, the antithesis of the mountains where he is. So I think he'd be a pretty good target for a really in-depth profile piece, and I just haven't seen that yet. If I were a reporter for a weekly that could write 4,000 words on this guy, I think that would be the time to do that.
Right.
So fast.
Well, they have one of those up in Asheville now.
Yeah. The Mountain Express could do that, I think. So fast forward. Now we're in October.
So he's not someone with sort of deep roots in this sort of mountainous Western North Carolina region.
I don't think so. I don't think
right,
so. And
okay.
I think that's why we're going to see him kind of, get tagged as someone who might just be kind of a pawn in this shadow conservative movement's game to shut down the government. Maybe he's not this guy with a lot of, power. Certainly he doesn't have a lot of power in the House. He's only been there for 8 months. But
right.
He's the guy who wrote this letter, and he's the guy that created this tangible document with a list of names that everybody can point to. And now
right.
that the government's actually shut down, you've seen him start to kind of run away from it. And he's been quoted in the Citizen Times saying, I'm not for a government shutdown. I even think he's went as far as to say, there's no quote out there that says I'm for a government shutdown.
Right.
Fox News asked him whether he was for the shutdown, and that's when he kind of he blamed the media. He says it was never his intent. He says that we have been trying to work with John Boehner, but the Citizen Times kind of came out and kind of called him out for trying to have it both ways. And this is an area in North Carolina, we'll probably talk about some of the impacts that the shutdown's actually having. And a lot of that impact is going on in his area there. It's Western North Carolina, borders Tennessee, and it's a really
yep.
beautiful area right now because of the leaves are changing colors, and they have a lot of fall foliage tourism, similar to you see in states like Vermont. And the Blue Ridge Parkway, while the road's still open, you can't camp there. And park rangers were literally throwing people out of campgrounds in the Great Smoky Mountains and in the Blue Ridge Parkway because it's a national park, and an inn shut down, and maybe you've heard about this, it was called the Pisgah Inn. It's a private business operated on federal land, and they were told they had to shut down, and they kind of had this, the innkeeper was kind of standing up to the government saying, we're not going to do that, threatened legal action, and I think just today he was allowed to keep it open. And so it's kind of like this, David Goliath story playing out there in the mountains. Meanwhile, the reporters in North Carolina are trying to see what Meadows' constituents think about this. And
right.
they should be. Freedom Works held an event recently where about 20 people were rallying for him. And, of course, he's telling the media all the time that the Tea
Party... How many people?
About 20 people. And to add it was outside of a county courthouse. And to add some local color, the Citizen Times gave the man on the street interview to a 15-year-old who was, talking about the medical device tax for the elderly or something like that. So that was pretty funny. So he's trying to have it both ways. I think the congressman's telling...
He was well-briefed. The teenager was well-briefed on the talking points of the day.
Yeah. But he's saying that he's not for the shutdown, but you know, even months ago, we saw headlines in papers in North Carolina that said he was leading the charge for government shutdown.
Right.
And I think, like, one thing we could talk about is, you know, whether now that we see someone like him kind of walking away from the issue after it happened, it kind of makes me wonder if, you know, people like him really do see really do feel that there's going to be political repercussions for this. And in an editorial, his hometown paper asked, I think the line was, "We don't know whether he'll face political repercussions for being called the guy behind the shutdown. We think he might even be rewarded."
Right.
And that, I think, just speaks to kind of a larger context of this political polarization that we're seeing all across the country and all across these states where we have these very safe districts. And I think a vocal minority can feel that they're completely backed, they're completely supported by these extreme positions that have serious consequences in their districts. When they're consistently rewarded by groups like FreedomWorks, by groups like the Tea Party, who maybe if they only draw a rally of 20 people, all say the same thing and say, you know, we're for the ideological philosophy of what they're doing, and that's why we sent them to office.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what's going on with Meadows, because, I mean, at least in that case, you have a lot of, there is a fair amount of media coverage, it sounds like, from the Asheville Press. So, and he's talking to folks. So we maybe are going to get a little bit of a test case there, right? Where, like, he is closely identified with this. People are relatively well informed about it, which is interesting. You know, there's some other, we've had some other stuff on the site where, in other sort of safe districts, like, I think one of the things I'm trying to say is that some of these sort of safe Republican districts are far removed from media markets.
Oh, yeah.
So you even wonder like what sort of coverage, you know, there even is. We had another piece, by a writer out of the Midwest about, Tim Hulskamp's, district out in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think the biggest paper there is like the Hutchinson News or something like that. And we spoke to the editor and he's like, we can't even get his office like on the phone. You know, they talk to Fox News or they talk to national media.
Yeah. And I think you can see that in South Carolina, maybe with someone uh-huh. like Congressman Mick Mulvaney. Now, Mick Mulvaney, I believe he was a signatory on that list on Meadows' letter. Yeah, he was. So a majority of the Republicans, congressional delegation in North Carolina and South Carolina, or according to FreedomWorks, are signatories on that letter, by the way.
Right. Yeah. It's primarily from sort of the South and the Midwest.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think
where they feel there's no consequences for such things. And say someone like, to go back to what you were talking there, like Mick Mulvaney, is a relatively obscure congressman as well. He beat the House budget chairman, John Spratt, in 2010. John Spratt had been there for 30 years. And people had split their tickets for him for decades. Republicans voted for John Spratt because he was he always supported Shaw Air Force Base. He was like one of these guys who just had that old school South Carolina constituent services mentality. He was the dean of the congressional delegation, and Mick Mulvaney was like an obscure state House member who jumped up to become an obscure state Senate member very quickly and then ran for Congress. And I remember I wrote about that campaign for the Huffington Post, and I talked to Spratt a few times, and he said to me, you know, he'd refer to him as this guy. This guy is not any better than any of the candidates I've faced before when it comes to substance. But I think he felt like he was going to get slaughtered because of this conservative movement in 2010 and all this outside money, and the demographics had changed. You know, Mulvaney represents an area of South Carolina where people live, but they all work, a lot of them work in Charlotte, the suburban area that, you know, was turning more red. And so now you have a kind of a backbencher who serves this district that's used to be represented by this really statesman-like figure. And I see Mick Mulvaney's the congressman who goes like on NBC, MSNBC a lot, and you see kind of him written about more, I think, in the national media, covered in the national media more than the local media. There's a paper, that the Sumter Item, there that, you know, they do an interview with him, a sit-down interview with him once in a while when he's in the district and stuff. But, for instance, he put out a news release to his constituents about the government shutdown, and while it might have been reported in the local press, the New York Times actually took his entire news release and annotated it and did this kind of, that was a New York Times blog, and did this kind of snarky annotation of his news release. And I thought that that's something that, you know, a local paper might consider, might do, but, you know, the New York Times jumped on that. Because these guys, even though they come from small districts, they represent backwoods areas of a state like South Carolina, they have such sharpened national profiles right now that the national media can really, you know, go to them and, you know, get them on the record.
Right, right. And it is, I mean, you were talking a little bit a moment ago about the sort of political polarization issue. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, you know, sort of if there are any political repercussions for the sort of the core conservatives from these safe districts. And this often gets talked about in terms of gerrymandering, and that, you know, probably plays a little role. But I think you said something important about sort of the demographics of these districts changing and the sort of general self-sorting of the electorate, where you have people, basically Democrats, you know, much more concentrated, Republicans much more concentrated than they once were. People don't split tickets anymore.
Yeah.
New York Times had an interesting story today about, you know, this is, you know, the White House has been waiting, I think, for the business community to break with these conservative Republicans and sort of like pleading for it to happen almost. And that, you know, the Times, it may have represented, you know, wishful thinking on the part of some folks more than anything else, but the Times had a story today saying that, you know, sort of the business establishment, while they would never do something as crazy as, you know, support Democrats, may actually get into some of these Republican House races and start supporting sort of more, you know, mainstream establishment type conservatives in primaries. It'll be interesting to see if that actually happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, another kind of like interesting, you know, sort of story to follow at the local level, I think. I mean, I'd like to hear more about what local business interests think about the direction of the sort of House Republican caucus from these places. And, I don't know if you've seen that in your reporting, but presumably these folks are sort of backed by sort of core activists in these districts who support their positions, even as we're sort of starting to see the implications of the shutdown and some pushback about that.
You can't imagine a government shutdown is good for business. So you're right. Maybe it takes something like this for the business community to maybe realize that supporting, you know, hardcore conservatives isn't in their best interest. I don't know. But when you've got if you're thinking that maybe this goes as far as the Chamber of Commerce and say Freedom Works or Americans for Limited Government or the Senate Conservative Fund would probably be like, imagine a primary battle where you had the Chamber of Commerce and the Senate's Conservatives Fund just waging a massive air war over a Republican primary in a state like South Carolina. That would be interesting to watch. And maybe, you know, one person we might want to talk about is Mark Sanford.
Yeah.
The former governor of South Carolina, who was disgraced because of the affair in Argentina, and he comes back last year to win a congressional seat, this year to win a congressional seat that he used to hold in the 90s, back when the government was shut down before. And here he is back in Congress representing that same area. And he's one of the very few, if not the only, he's the only congressman I know of who flew home over the weekend and slapped together a town hall within 24 hours in North Charleston and spoke to the crowd for an hour and a half. I was there. He said, I'll be here as long as you guys want to stay here. If you know Mark Sanford, you know, he would have done that. And the room was about maybe 150 people. I'd say maybe 30, you know, pro-Obama folks there, pro-healthcare folks there. But he got an earful from people that voted for him, who would stand up and say, Mark, I voted for you, but you guys got to stop this nonsense. And Mark Sanford is an incredible politician. He deftly made it sound like he wasn't even a Republican. Watching it was, it was incredible because he was blaming both sides. And I asked him after.
I mean, the guy has a pretty strong brand identity as a Republican. I mean, he's a statewide elected official. Can he really sort of like persuade people that he's...
He said that the Republicans overplayed their hand and the Democrats overplayed their hand. And every time somebody would stand up and say, you know, why are you part of this government shutdown? And he'd say, well, it's part of a larger philosophy of spending. And if we don't have this conversation now, if we don't force this debate now, we're just going to kick the can down the road until October or November, and then we'll be right back where we started. So we have to have this conversation now. And I don't think he gave, you know, he didn't tell people what they wanted to hear. People were telling him, pass a clean CR. And he, the second time somebody brought it up, he had a pen and paper. He said, okay, I get it. I hear them. I got your message. Two clean CRs. I understand. And then he'd say, but I'm struggling with that. Because if we pass a clean CR...
People in the crowd are actually saying, pass a clean CR?
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah.
It's interesting to get, like, people throwing out clean CR. I mean, these people are, watching TV, reading the news or whatever.
And like I said, they put this thing together in 24 hours. So it's people that just, you know, heard about it and showed up. And Mark Sanford also should be noted, he had an editorial in the Charleston Post and Courier, which is a great local paper, probably one of the best papers, if not the best paper in South Carolina. And his headline was, Why the Federal Government Shutdown is Warranted. Now, I asked him if he wrote that headline, and he said no. And he kind of rolled his eyes and said, you know, they wrote that.
Shades of Mitt Romney. And
And I actually brought that up to his chief of staff, and he kind of said, yeah, you know, I think that's kind of what's going on here. But the piece was basically like, you know, we can use these blunt political tools to force conversations, and that's what we need to do here. And so when I said to him, you know, what do you tell people who think you're for this government shutdown, you're behind this idea, he said, well, you know, who would be for a shutdown? And so it's another example, I think, of one of these guys in these safe seats just trying, you know, having it both ways. You know, they're certainly taking part in this process, this strategy that shut the government down. And then when it happens, kind of being able to back off and say, you know, well, this is a, you know, we were sent here to repeal or defeat or defund Obamacare. And we're going to do what it takes to do it. And whether that, you know, whether they do suffer political consequences for that, I mean, we're not going to see for it until the next election. And and I can tell you, I live in Charleston. I report in Charleston. Mark Sanford can be congressman for life if he wants to in this district, no matter what he does.
What is his base? Like, I mean, well, I mean, he's a sort of unique, I mean, he's obviously widely known, right? Mm-hmm. Like everybody knows who he is. So he's just sort of like broadly popular. He's not depending on sort of support of a core group, I imagine.
Not like someone like, you know, Mark Meadows in North Carolina, who I think basically just listens to what the Tea Party says and then thinks that if he gets three or four phone calls from the Tea Party activists, that he's representing his constituents.
Gotcha. Is there anything else going on in South Carolina? Like you mentioned Graham earlier. Is there sort of like discord within the GOP delegation there?
Yeah. Well, the Lindsey Graham's kind of an odd duck in the South Carolina political sphere. South Carolina's its state house is now full of kind of liberty movement, libertarian types. We have Governor Nikki Haley, who beat a lot of establishment Republicans before other establishment Republicans in the governor's race in 2010 by capturing the Tea Party vote. We've got Tim Scott now as our other senator who identifies with the Tea Party, and of course he replaced the shadow speaker, Jim DeMint. And we have congressional delegation who are largely backbenchers who all won their elections by saying they were going to go to Washington and get rid of Obamacare. And yet, Lindsey Graham, as a great reporter Peter Hamby from CNN put it, is the only scalp that the movement has yet to take. And he gets votes from Democrats. He gets crossover support. Now, he is in a primary fight, but he doesn't have, you know, traditionally credible opponents. A state senator, Nancy Mace, who's the first woman graduate of the Citadel, and a social conservative activist who owns a fleet of ice cream trucks. Those are his three primary opponents right now. So I don't think he's too worried, but there is this idea, you know, how long can a more moderate voice in the Republican Party stay elected in a state like South Carolina? And I think that's certainly an election to watch coming up.
Gotcha. Is the we spoke a little bit about the business community before. I mean, I know Boeing recently sort of opened up. It was a big national story. Fight over the National Labor Relations Board. We got that big facility in Charleston, obviously highly dependent on government contracting. Are they are they politically active down there? Have you seen any indication of them trying to influence discussion one way or the other?
I haven't. And I think that we might see them because there's an interesting story playing out that just kind of came out in the past couple days where, so Boeing has a plant here in North Charleston, but also they manufacture planes in Washington State. Now they moved to South Carolina to get away from the unions in Washington State. And South Carolina gave them almost $1 billion in tax incentives to come down here. We made it attractive for them. They've been here. The state loves to talk about how they brought Boeing here. For some reason, the FAA delegates the oversight for plane deliveries and production and stuff in Washington to Boeing, to the company. But in South Carolina, the FAA actually oversees that. And I'm not sure why exactly, but because of that, the planes that are being made in Washington right now, there's been no problem because of the government shutdown, but it's it impacted FAA employees who can't go to work, and therefore planes cannot be delivered from South Carolina. And I think if that story starts, I mean, The Economist wrote about it, I was looking around trying to see if I could see something in some local papers here over the last couple of days, and I think that's going to be a big story. And as The Economist put it, this is an interesting angle on this. Could this be a possibility where we see reform because of the government shutdown? And I think we're seeing this in a lot of sectors as well, where the press kind of finds out some of these things that are being impacted by the government shutdown that members of Congress and the president never even considered. And I think this is definitely one of them.
Got it. Cool. Corey, anything else that we should talk about in terms of the shutdown politics or economics in your region?
Well, to localize it a little bit more, we've seen the World War II veterans storming the memorial. And I just can't wait to write the headline when the Sons of Confederate veterans get on paddle boards and storm Fort Sumter. That hasn't happened yet.
Next week, maybe.
Okay.
That'll be fun. That'll bring some traffic, maybe.
Yeah.
To the site.
No, I think that does it.
All right, cool.
You too. All right, take care, Greg.